This is Hayley Rose. She's an ex-YouTube employee that now helps creators like you get more views.
I was growing books from zero, and really quickly they were growing from zero subscribers or zero views up to upwards of hundreds of millions of views within a month.
She founded her agency, The Upload Club, last year, and her clients are already bringing in 200 million views a month.
In 2020, there was 200,000 full-time equivalent creators. Now there is 1.5 million. I think that is a huge opportunity.
The market for this is already huge, and it's not going to stop growing. Like, if you can turn this thing on, it's free distribution with billions of people.
Some people are really good at this. Some people are less good at this. What are the most important metrics to focus on?
Great question. I'd say top three. So impressions, click-through rate, and...
Welcome back to the Creator Spotlight Podcast. My name is Francis Zierer, and today we're speaking with Hayley Rose, a YouTube growth strategist who spent a decade working at Google and YouTube before leaving to start her YouTube strategy agency, The Upload Club, last year. Before we started recording, Hayley told me that The Upload Club's work is currently driving around 200 million YouTube views per month across her client portfolio, and that including her time working at YouTube, her work has impacted close to 100 billion, with a B, total views across both shorts and long form. So, Hayley, thank you for coming on. But first, what allows you to say 100 billion? The numbers don't add up. How does that work?
Yeah, well, first off, thank you for having me. It's awesome to be here. I'm a huge fan of the newsletter. So, yeah, just stoked to be here. So while I was at YouTube, I worked on a team called the Top Creator Acquisitions Team. So we were working with the top YouTube talent, meaning the talent that had the biggest channels. My team specifically was responsible for, my old team was responsible for acquiring large TikTokers and podcast channels like off of YouTube and bringing them onto YouTube. So the goal was to grow incremental viewership on the YouTube platform by bringing these massive folks on other platforms onto YouTube. So when that happened, when I was acquiring these, you know, large creators, I was growing folks from zero. And really quickly, they were growing from zero subscribers or zero views up to upwards of hundreds of millions of views within a month on both shorts and long form. So over my 3-year tenure there, and I worked with, I think, between 30 to 40 different creators and about a dozen podcasts. My rough calculations come out to somewhere between 100 and 150 billion. So weirdly, 100 billion is on the conservative side.
We'll take it. We'll take it. Okay. So I do want to jump quickly into some of the tactical bits. You have this anatomy of an upload system. But right before we do that, with the Upload Club, what are your core services? What do you offer clients, just to clarify?
Yes. So the Upload Club is a growth consultancy. Folks mainly come to us to grow on YouTube and make more money on YouTube. And there's a couple of different ways we help clients do just that. It's really three main components. We have the YouTube channel audit, which is a one-off service. That's for clients or for creators that have an established channel and they're looking to get a health check on the channel. Maybe they have grown really quickly, but their growth has plateaued. Maybe they want to venture into a new content series, but they're not really sure how to build that bridge between their existing audience and the new audience. Really, they're coming to us with a very specific ask or request. And by us taking a really deep dive into the data and then coming up with some recommendations, we can deliver that kind of an audit to give them those next steps to unlock the next phase. Typically what happens, what we love to happen, is that ideally that audit then opens the way for us to show what a long-term partnership with Upload Club can look like. So after we've done this one-off analysis for you and we provide you with all these recommendations and suggestions, how can you then execute on those suggestions? Well, that's where we can come in to help you take all of those recommendations and those goals that we've helped basically collaborate with you to define and execute on all that. We call that a retainer. It's not like a traditional retainer or, you know, by kind of definition, that exact retainer format, but it's a long-term retainer partnership And then the third and final component is thumbnail testing. So what we do with clients is, and often where we spend most of our time, is educating them to understand that pre-production and specifically packaging, aka the thumbnail and the title, are so crucial. Meaning I won't allow you to work on a YouTube video unless we create the thumbnail and the title first, and we know it will resonate with your audience and we can design it in a really visually compelling way. There's always a handful of ideas that are good ideas, but they don't translate well into a thumbnail. So we design all those thumbnails and we test them before we even get into script writing or scoping out the film day. So yeah, those are the three.
Yeah. It strikes me I've heard so many times, it's like, you know, Mr. Beast has said it, Colin Samiro has said it, that, you know, YouTube is a game of thumbnails and titles. If you can't get somebody to click, what's the point? You got to distribute stuff. But I was starting to think about the idea that you don't judge a book by its cover, right? I think on YouTube especially, but really in the creator economy and the attention economy generally, it is a game of cover design. Nobody's going to read the book if you don't have a good cover that gets people to open it, stretching the metaphor a little bit. But yeah, it's never, this is something I've been on a lot recently, is that, like, yes, the information matters, but it doesn't matter if nobody gets to it. And so you kind of help people who maybe are more focused on the information, on writing the book, let's say, making the video, you help them figure out how to market their work.
Yes, absolutely. And, a couple of things there. So, there's sort of the sort of shadow side, or the like potential way this can kind of go the wrong direction with thumbnails, is that you turn the thumbnail into clickbait. And it be the thumbnail, because it is so important, I find creators will kind of over index on making it really compelling and really selling the viewer on something that it's not. That also can really, that can backfire, because what then happens, inevitably the viewer clicks through, they watch, and they realize the video is not about what they promised in the thumbnail. Mm-hmm. So there's, you know, severe drop off, average view duration is low, retention curve is pathetic. YouTube's then going to not sort of continue to impress that, you know, video onto viewers. So really the finesse is in understanding like how to authentically package this up and speak to the viewer in a way that's going to like kind of subconsciously motivate them. So you have both sort of like your subconscious reactions as a viewer to colors and composition, but then also the why or the motive or the incentive, which is, oh, am I going to learn something? Will this show me something that I wasn't aware of? Teach something, entertain me. Those are kind of the core reasons.
Okay, so I still want to get to the 5-step anatomy of an upload system, but one thing there I want to touch on. What are, let's say, I don't know if it's three, you tell me the number, the most important metrics that you kind of train your clients to focus on? Hey, if you're enjoying this conversation, consider subscribing to the podcast. We release a new episode every Tuesday. All right, back to the show.
Great question. I'd say top three. So impressions, click-through rate, and views. Mm-hmm. I would argue that like average view duration, average percentage viewed is up there too. But where we are laser focused, and especially in the first few hours of an upload, is looking at impressions. So how many viewers did did YouTube serve your content up to? Of those viewers, how many click through? And then once they're there, did they, you know, did that translate into an actual view? And then even better, did it translate into someone who watched for over 50%, over 60% of the video? Mm-hmm.
This is bringing me to something that you mentioned when we spoke a few weeks back before we even decided to do this, where you said that your clients usually have, I think you said like a million, an audience of a million, whether it's on YouTube or elsewhere, which I remember that in the way that you were saying, like, we monitor in the first few hours to make sure like they're getting all these views, which, speaking from my experience with the Creator Spotlight YouTube channel, we're definitely, you know, in the first few hours we're getting some views, but the difference is not so variable that kind of thinking would apply to what I'm doing. So I guess I'm asking for clarification on like the size of creator you're usually working with.
Yes. So usually quite large, like several hundred thousand subscribers up to upwards of 20 million subscribers. We've worked with a few folks that are more in that like emerging zone as well, that might have more like established businesses or a large Instagram following, for example. The sort of that pattern or that kind of behavior that we teach clients to adopt, which is to be really present in those first few hours, especially, and also throughout the first 7 days. I can kind of speak to that first 7 days window and the importance of that later. It's going to be that sort of behavior is important for every creator. I would encourage even you to start doing that too with your YouTube channel. I would say that it just, the sort of reactions look different based on the size. So for example, if you're a creator that usually gets a million impressions within the first 2 hours, let's say that's your goal because you're trying to ensure that you get to 50,000 views in the first few hours. We know that if you get to 50,000, then you typically get to 300,000 within the first few days, and then you get to a million within the first week, which if you get to a million in the first week, that means over, you know, the next 20, we can kind of start to draw these sort of like predictions, if you will. And so, you know, we're able to react really quickly in those cases. We get so much data within that first 30 minutes, 1 hour. If about 4 or 5 hours pass and we see that the CTR is lower than 10%, for example, or lower than that benchmark that we've created, then it's time to swap the thumbnail. So we always have a plan B, sometimes a plan C for thumbnail and title. If, especially if we're taking a risk, if the packaging is a little bit different, if the sort of like concept of the video is a little bit different, we make sure we have that. And then for emerging creators, I would say that, you know, it's hard to be able to have to make an informed decision within just a few hours of posting the long form. I would encourage you to wait a little bit longer because it's going to take YouTube longer to serve that content out to like enough of a sample size for you to say, okay, people aren't clicking through. So for your channel, for example, yeah, I'd wait at least a couple of days, maybe even a couple of weeks, because you're not getting a billion views quite yet.
Producer soon. Tom, I'm speaking directly to you. Pay attention to that. Okay, let's finally, I keep saying this, let's finally walk through your five-step anatomy of an upload system. So I'll read, you've sent me these five steps. I'll read them out and then we can go through them more slowly. So number one is the idea. Is it actually worth making? Is it viable for YouTube? Number two is pre-production. Can you draft the title, thumbnail, and script before you shoot? Number three is shoot day. Can you make film days or batch film days sustainable and exciting? Number four is edit. Can you kill your darlings and speak editor? And number five is upload. Do you have a plan B if the video flops in the first few hours, which is what we were just talking about? So let's, I don't know if that you want to say anything more high level before we start going through this. I'll give you the chance to do that.
Sure. I would say, this is a great, really oversimplified step-by-step process. And I would say that the different stages take different amounts of time, or different steps take different amounts of time. And what you end up getting kind of evolving to as hopefully a client or a creator that I know or work with, is to a place where this feels really casual. So, a lot of the creators that we work with in the beginning, they feel so nervous and precious about YouTube, which makes sense. Like, this is your living. This is how you make, your living. This is your life. And, you kind of feel like you're at the whim of the algorithm, which I kind of feel like there's some sort of misconceptions about the algorithm and how I see that and how they kind of, creators or folks in the space kind of refer to it, put a pin in that for later. But I think that the kind of intention or like root behind this step-by-step process is to make YouTube feel digestible and make it feel more approachable. It is such a complex place. It's a complex platform. It's old, you know, it's 20 years old, older than the others. So it's advanced. And my goal again with this process is to make it feel really casual and also to build the trust with YouTube and know that it's working for you. Like, if you can turn this thing on, it's free distribution with billions of people. It's worth you know, it's worth the iteration. So hopefully this plan can give people the ability to ramp up productivity and get the reps in, as we say.
I one aside, the way you talk, calling YouTube old, I wonder if, you know, like there's dog years, internet years, maybe is like five. So it's, you know, YouTube's like 100 years old and internet years maybe.
I like that. Yeah, we'll that makes sense. Okay, it sure so, feels that way.
Yeah, I mean, and you were at Google/YouTube for half of it, which we'll get into that a little bit later too. But okay, so the idea stage, say, specifically you said, like, is it worth making? Is it viable for YouTube? How do you validate this? And maybe can you give me examples of, I don't know, doesn't have to be a specific client, a specific idea, maybe you can generalize, but how do you validate it? And what are some examples of ideas where you've been like, no, that's not valid? And how did you arrive at that?
Yeah. So the idea phase, I love the idea phase because it's actually not data driven. I actually want clients, creators in this phase to remove all limitation, right? Or like, oh, da 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 da, I'm not sure, this might not fit into this, or, you know, we tried this, so it's not going to work. It's more of like when you go into acting improv class and they teach you about yes and. It should always be a yes and conversation when you're in this idea phase. So the point is that you're trying to get down as many ideas as possible. We can filter them. I'll be there to filter the ones out for you. But we want to kind of cast as big of a net, as wide of a net as possible. With ideation, I mentioned it's not data driven for a reason, because I feel like oftentimes the best ideas come from the weirdest, non-traditional places, also when people are relaxed. So if you're nervous and stressed about coming up with a concept and it has to be perfect, you're going to kind of start to close off those walls creatively and not be able to access that kind of flow. So once we have, you know, huge brainstorms, sometimes it takes a couple of sessions to get all the ideas down. Maybe we talk about ideas and then over the next week, everyone starts to dump those ideas into a doc. And then it's time to start to understand if they're viable or not. Viability means a couple of things. One, will this, you know, it's all under the umbrella of, will this perform well on YouTube? Which means that the piece of content has to be valuable and or entertaining and or format well for YouTube. And what's ideal is if you can then validate it with a bit of data. So whether that's from your own channel or from external resources, like we reference Google Trends a lot. Sometimes Tubular is an option for me to take a look at. I'm lucky in that sense. I can kind of take a peek at data from some of these third-party platforms. There's other platforms like ViewStats, but really you're then taking all the ideas and cross-referencing them with, is this a concept that will likely do well on YouTube? Once you've whittled it down to that next sort of section or segment of ideas, that's when we start drafting thumbnail designs and running
pre-production
tests.
Stage.
Well, actually I would argue that like the tests are still a part of ideation. Because the tests actually are the thing that green lights the concept kicking off pre-production. So in addition to the thumbnail, writing the script, and we're really starting to plan out how this video is going to come to life. Does that make sense?
That does make sense. One thing I'm thinking of here too is how you talk about not being too data driven. Something somebody said to me a couple of years ago is like, the danger with following best practices is that if everybody follows best practices, you arrive, you produce an average piece of, whether it's content or whatever it is, you end up with an average result. So I like that you're framing this as like the time to not really worry about best practices, which I imagine that comes in later, perhaps at the shoot day phase, which is like when you need to be highly organized. But I'm getting a step ahead. Talk to me about the pre-production stage.
So pre-production, I'll dive into that. And then I'll talk a little bit just about, I think, the importance of quantitative and qualitative, or having both creativity and data. And that's kind of really the philosophy of like why I'm even doing this whole Upload Club thing. But pre-production, so pre-production includes all basically defining, drafting, finalizing as much as we can, elements that are required to unlock the best film day and kind of upload and editing and upload process. So pre-production includes agreeing or sort of committing to the thumbnail. So we've gotten the test back where we're like, wow, the click-through rate was highest for this one. Let's draft out like 4 or 5 options for the title. And then let's go into a script outline. And then once we've committed to a script outline, we then start drafting out the script. But we also stay away from word for word scripting. It depends on the talent. Sometimes talent can be excellent with a teleprompter. Other times it's like a death wish and they become robotic and they have no charisma or anything that was the thing that grew them to that point, you know? So, the sort of like way that the script looks will be dependent on what works best for the talent. Typically it's not word for word. And so what we are doing though, is we're ensuring that we're setting up the talent with what the purpose of the segment or the scene is. And then also really important components like foreshadowing lines. So teasing out what's coming, you know, ensuring that we have those mechanisms in place so that people do stick around toward the end of the video, or that we're doing as much as we possibly can to encourage them to stay. Like Dental Digest, for example, comment CTAs work really well for his content. He does kids content, like mukbang, cavity. He's a dentist. We will ensure that we do in every long form is have him say like comment your favorite color, or comment, you know, the color of the Easter egg that we've hidden in the video, the first person
at certain points throughout the video.
And we'll make it into a competition. Like the first person who comments the right color or the right thing will get their comment pinned. And like, that's a huge incentive for a kid, right? To watch, to engage and like watch the every little detail in the video, which really helps with retention.
Very sticky. Yeah. Okay. So pre-production, I'm getting like, you know, it's variable per client. I think the point about, how hard you're scripting it, how specifically you're scripting it is a good one. I mean, yes. I was at the Webby Awards on Monday and they had a teleprompter, and I'm thinking there specifically, I was taking note of how some people were really good. Alana Glazer was the host, right? From Broad City. She was killing it with the teleprompter. But then there was a couple other people where I could tell it was like, this is more of an improv person. You know, they are like stumbling over the words, like kind of squinting at it. I don't know. There's no deep insight there. Just that you have to know your strengths, and I guess it's your job to help people maybe understand their strengths. Side question here: like you're talking about Dental Digest or some of your other clients, how many people is that you're usually working with? Like this is like, is it like a team of like 5 people across various roles? Like how are you? And the way you're talking about like, you know, pre-production and ideation, it sounds like it's a lot of work. It can be really in depth. What's the scale of the teams?
Yeah, it varies. I'd say it's between 3 and 5, sometimes a few more. Depends on the size. So if the creator has a huge business, maybe not even like a huge YouTube presence, but let's say they have a large business, they have presence across all these different social platforms, and they're just trying to grow their business and YouTube is a funnel. That's actually usually the biggest team, like size of team that we're working with, because there's so many folks that are involved in all the content, the process or the approach of the content. So you have PR, you have head of content, you have operations, even we're chatting with them sometimes. So those are usually the largest teams. And then on the kind of like content creator side, when creators start getting into that multi-million, multi-million subscriber range, I'm kind of trying to translate that into like viewership, because that translates into revenue. When they're getting into, over 100 million views a month, for example, that means that you're uploading a certain amount of videos per month. Let's say at least 4 long form and like 30 shorts. Even just producing like 4 long form a month that are closer to 20, 30 minutes, that takes a lot of work, especially if it's scripted, if it's maybe not more of like a podcast format. Still, there's a lot of pre-production that goes into that. If you're a doctor, you need to do a ton of research, right? And so if you're an athlete, you need to do research on your guests and like kind of start to think about what are the best topics to talk about. You still want to do the research to understand what are those controversial questions, the most asked questions that we can ask and like clip out and put in the intro. So we have a really compelling intro, which is probably what you're doing with your episodes.
Yeah. Well, you know, maybe 3 hours of 3 hours, probably 3 to 4 these days of research. So not quite that much, but I can do it better. Let's be clear. I could definitely do it better.
You're killing it.
Thank you. I'm trying. Lot left to do until we're at that 100 million views a month.
I'll help
range.
You get there.
I could use it. Okay, let's move on to the shoot day phase, though. Okay, so this, you mentioned specifically when you sent over some notes beforehand that this is a phase that a lot of creators really miss and don't really understand why it's so important. And I think this goes back into that best practices thing. Like, this is actually where best practices are most important, which I think also some creators, some creatives, perhaps is a better way of putting it, can feel allergic to that over-systemization.
Yes.
But it's important here. So tell me all
about it. Yeah, that's a really great way to say it. I think that that's also what it feels like when I've been, you know, I don't often go to shoot days. I like to kind of, it helps with sort of the creator understanding where Upload Club comes in and then where we end, meaning we are present and help you with all things needed in order to set you up for the best shoot day. Sometimes I'm on set just making sure everything goes seamlessly, but oftentimes I'm wanting to, of course, depends on the size of the creator. If you're big enough to have a director, a producer, videographer on set, I want to be sure that everything has been built to empower them to get the best end product out of the talent. And when we do over script and over prepare, I don't know if it's those are the right words. When we spend a lot of time pre-producing things word for word, that's when a creator can start to feel suffocated and a little itchy. Like, I honestly do think having an allergic reaction, like I see that in their kind of skin and how it shows up. And then it translates into the whatever reporting and content we're making. So it really just comes down to the person. And it's easy for me to understand where the sort of threshold or preference is going to be, because we're talking so much to the client in that ideation and pre-production phase that by the time that you start writing scripts, you know what's going to work best. But yeah, I would say like a lot of folks or a lot of creators are not spending enough time in pre-production. So film day is chaos. And so the best feeling, one of the best feelings, other than having a 1 of 10 for your long form video, my dopamine is like directly connected to when like things separate from the gray bar. I'll show you that later. But basically, one of the best feelings is that you've done all the kind of work you can do to set yourself up for success on the film day. So that film day feels a lot more seamless. You're saving time, because what that means is that the creator is going to want to make more and more content, which is a big part of growth. Like, all these best practices and this flow makes sense, but if you're not uploading, then you're not able to grow.
Yeah. I mean, it's the, you have to upload. That's the number one thing. You just do it. But I think the second thing is like, you also have to actively learn from and study the performance of each time. Okay. Well, the next phase is edit, which I think is a tough one. I think it's especially a tough one for people who are working solo. Some people are really good at this. Some people are less good at this. I know that in my own work with writing, it's like, it's very hard for me to really be decisive on an edit on a piece. If I'm editing it the same day I wrote it, I need to wait a day later. And now that I'm working with Natalia, our assistant editor here, she's listening, shout out to her. It's very helpful because she can take a look. And then when she's writing, I can take a look at her thing. And I haven't been steeped in it. And it's so much easier to make the hard decisions.
Yes.
So how do you help people do this? And how do you train people to be more decisive as an editor?
Yeah, absolutely. I think this part is one of my favorite parts, because it's easy for me to step in and tell someone, cut that out, or we need to Django this. And like, this is actually the most compelling segment. We need to put it up front so we can give the sort of retention curve the best bet it can have. I would say to kind of speak to more the sort of like emerging creator or a creator that's editing themselves or trying to find an editor, which many creators that are not emerging that are established are just doing that. Just to speak to kind of that sort of target audience a little bit, because I'd like to speak to that a little bit more because I know how painful it is to be in that space. And it's finding an editor, a trusted editor, is really hard. And then keeping them is also hard. So there's a couple of things that you can kind of do as a creator to set yourself up for that process to be a little bit more seamless. And one of those things that I end up doing for clients, but creators could do themselves, is once you get all the raw footage back, if you can learn Final Cut or an editing software enough to be able to compile a rough cut, which shouldn't be too hard, because if you've done the pre-production and you know how things work, like, you can probably put a rough cut together. Take that rough cut, upload it into Frame, and then start marking the different segments and map them to the script that you've written, and start to give the editor like what you kind of think could be good from a creative standpoint. I've seen this work really well for creators that are just getting started with a new editor. And then eventually over time, the editor learns the aesthetic or the sort of creative direction, and then they're able to mimic or create it themselves. But I also recommend doing this because it's going to save you so much time and money, because editors price based on video, or sometimes they price per hour. And it's impossible for an editor to just nail it the first time out of the gates. Like, they're going to use plugins and fonts that a lot of their other clients use. And if you want to ensure that that's not the case with your content, you know, take the time to kind of write up a brand guidelines, take the time to give them an idea of the sort of flow of the video, because while they are editors, they're not creative directors.
Well, I think the thing you're talking about here is, like, this is about learning to translate your vision as a creator to other people and to delegate. And, like, you have to get into the, you have to get, roll your sleeves up, get in there, and
yeah,
like, make the, like, be like, I want to cut this. But then you leave a note for the editor and say, I want to cut this. Here's why. And this is something I do as a, you know, editing written pieces. It's like, the goal when you start working with somebody, you have to get in there and invest a lot of time as an editor early on and leave a thorough comment with every decision you're making and explain why. And then if you do this well, like, you know, the next time you do it, you'll have less comments and you'll spend less time editing. And, you know, a month later, 3 months later, whatever, 6 months later,
yes,
variable, you don't have to do it at all anymore. You're leaving like only 3 comments and you don't have to explain yourself because you have taught this person how you think and translated your vision to them.
Yes. Yes. Which again makes it even scarier to then like lose that person again. So it's like, how do you, you know, not to think in terms of like preparing for worst case scenario, but it's like, how can you kind of scale your brain and how you think and how you want the content to look to maybe 1 to 2 editors. And then also I think, you know, there are a lot of editors out there, but there aren't a lot of editors that know how to edit for YouTube well. And so I find myself having to train editors a lot to understand the importance of that first few frames and the first few seconds and intro. Because the intro are sort of, I mean, if you think about it now with YouTube, if you're scrolling on your phone or on desktop, your video is going to autoplay. So I almost consider the first few like seconds or frames of the video to be a part of the thumbnail. And some creators have actually gone as far as recreating the thumbnail in their first few frames so that when it autoplays, it's an extension of the thumbnail, but it also delivers on the promise that you're trying to set in the thumbnail design. Ryan Trahan does that really well. That takes a lot of planning though, right? Like, that should be planned for in your pre-production. It's like, okay, shot one, we're recreating the thumbnail. A lot of creators, by the way, they forget to take thumbnail pictures during the shoot. That's also really important because you might have some like photos, headshots or whatever that you can repurpose. But I find that the best assets for thumbnails are taken like the day that you're filming.
Yeah, because then it's just seamless.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I think like, yeah, so it's all those things. Hopefully that's helpful to understand in terms of like how to kind of find someone. There's job boards, but then how to really train someone, build trust, and then keep them with you, you know, it can be precious.
I can say from my own experience too, like our performance on YouTube and on RSS feeds with the podcast started getting better retention after we switched from like, oh, like let's, you know, focus all our time kind of throughout. Let's make a few clips. Let's make like a bunch of clips. Well, we're not using producer Tom. Hello to him. Shout out. We're not using his time well enough. So I was like, stop doing all that. Like all those clips don't matter if people aren't sticking around to watch. Spend like 50% of your time, more than that even, making that teaser trailer type intro that really gets people engaged overnight. You know, the engagement went up.
Awesome.
I find that too, like with writing, like what you were talking about like, you know, treating the intro as another thumbnail, this idea of like constantly creating new hooks. I'm more of a writer, so I'm getting better at the podcast form, but especially in writing the newsletter, it's always like, well, I should operate from the assumption that nobody really gives a shit about what I'm writing or what I'm saying. And so you have to keep selling them on it. Keep giving, this doesn't have to be like at the you know, expense of quality of narrative, whatever. It's actually strength of narrative. Keep opening hooks and you know, questions that keep them leaning in.
Yeah. And that also kind of goes back to the like ideation phase of, when you're first really starting to filter some ideas out, one of the questions we often talk about is, does this have a broad appeal? Mm-hmm. It's kind of like, you know, from marketing, it's sort of that, like, I think Patty Galloway calls it core casual new. CCN mm-hmm. yes. is a big part of his framework. You know, does this concept appeal? Does it have universal appeal? You know, it depends on the content vertical and type. Not every video is going to have a universal appeal, but I think there are things you can do to broaden a topic so that it does resonate with a bigger audience. And I do like those sort of like boundaries of, does it appeal to the core loyal audience that watches all of your content? Does it appeal to casual viewers that are kind of casually interacting with your audience, and the new, which is the sort of people that just have no idea that you exist? Mm-hmm. I think that's the really toughest question to answer sometimes, is like, is this, as a creator, me making the content, I don't necessarily have the perspective to be able to say, oh yeah, this does have universal appeal. So, you know, again, with like editing and having someone who isn't you come into the piece of content and say, you know, this is where it lags. Yeah, drags here. What is the point of this sentence? You know, we're not getting into the value fast enough. Like, again, easier for someone who's not the talent to come in and say this. Mm-hmm. I would say same thing here. So it's kind of like having that sort of third party person to not be ruthless, but just be present and give you the feedback is extremely valuable.
I agree. I think it is good to have somebody who's ruthless, though. And like, the mistake is not like, you know, in sports, an elite coach is going to like really push you and be ruthless. And that's how you become an elite athlete, right? I think it's the same here. Like, you have to be able to submit yourself to somebody's hard feedback. Okay. Last step of this, though, is the upload. And you say, do you have a plan B if the video flops in the first few hours? And like 20 minutes ago, too, you mentioned also the first 7-day window. So tell me about that upload and this idea of plan B for first few hours or even next 7 days.
Yeah. So this is my favorite part of the whole process. And it's what obviously my business is called. So the upload, I think that the moment right before the upload is a really interesting, like, kind of psychological, emotional, vulnerable moment for a lot of creators. And as you upload more, it feels less intense or maybe like less emotionally charged. But the reason why I named the company Upload Club is because I feel like every upload is like a mini moment to stand up for what you think is right or what you feel like you are about. And yes, you are doing all this work to like package it up to market the piece of content, but that content is a piece of you and it's scary. It can, you know, you're putting yourself out there. It's a kind of moment of vulnerability. I notice that when we start working with clients, because again, they've been a bit like afraid of YouTube. They're worried about doing something wrong so the algorithm doesn't like them anymore. My goal is again to help them feel more in collaboration or in partnership with YouTube, so uploads don't feel so scary. And again, the more reps and the growth and, you know, good performance that comes from the videos, the less scary it's going to feel. Another way that we can kind of mitigate the fear is to have a plan. So once the video goes live, as I've shared, we have a plan B, sometimes plan C for thumbnail and title. So if for whatever reason it flops within the first few days, depending on how big you are, we have something to do. And just having a plan B takes such a sharpness away from the whole moment, because it gives you hope and it gives you another opportunity to try to win more viewership. The sort of like different timelines we look at. So what we have found generally across the board with clients is that the first 7 days is an extremely important window. Typically, if you can outperform, 100% of the time with our clients, so we see if you can outperform in the first 7 days, meaning you can generate more views than all your other videos have in that first 7 days, you will have a video that is an outlier for the following few weeks, or we're then looking at 28 days since upload or since publish, mm-hmm. and then also an outlier for your lifetime for your channel. So
we should say, wait, really quick, we should say for anybody who's listening and does not upload to YouTube, when you go to your channel dashboard, on the left is a little thing that has your latest upload, and it tells you how out of 10 this video ranks to your last 10 videos. So what you're telling me is, with your clients, your goal is for every video to beat the previous one and be a 1 out of 10.
Ideally, 1 of 10 is ideal. I'm trying to get into that 3 of 10, 2 of 10, 1 of 10. Even a 4 of 10 is okay. I think when it starts to get to 5 out of 10 or lower, that's when we start to think about swapping out the thumb. Usually, like, it's interesting. I will say that, just again, within my client portfolio. So this is not like a big enough sample size, but just how we kind of, what we have seen is that it will either be like a 7 out of 10 or a 3 or a 2 out of 10. So that sort of middle zone is like a 5 of 10 doesn't happen that often. It either like doesn't hit with your loyal audience, or it really, really does. And of course we're trying to get it to hit in that sort of like 3 of 10 or higher. And I say it doesn't hit or it does hit with your loyal audience, because again, what we found in our data and research with clients, this isn't going to be true across the board, is that YouTube serves your video up first to people that are loyal followers, loyal subscribers, your core audience. They want to see how they react to it first before YouTube then makes a decision around whether or not to continue oppressing it upon new people. It's pretty fascinating. Like, I always thought that was interesting, that's often what we see, which is, again, like, it's serving it up to those people that always consume your videos. So if those people who are loyal to you, who love you, do also love that video, that gives YouTube the confidence to keep pushing it out. And ideally, it pushes it out eventually to new viewers. What creators will find is it's really hard to get to new viewers.
I have experienced that myself. okay, let's back out of the tactics for a little bit. That's the 5 steps done and dusted. Tell me about your time at YouTube a little bit, what you did there, how you got in there. I understand that you were at Google/YouTube total for around a decade. First, like, 6.5 years were within Google, and then you were part of this internal startup incubator where, for any listeners who don't know, sometimes these big, you know, the big tech companies will have these internal incubators where they're trying to disrupt themselves. And you're like working, you're owned by the company, but not really working for it. And I think it was called Area 120 there. And you were working on something called Rodeo, which is your entree into YouTube.
Yes. Yes. I miss my rodeo guys.
not your first rodeo.
Not my first rodeo. And I just also love, the name was so good.
Yeah.
It is so good. It actually still exists. Oh. It exists within YouTube Eng engineering today. So I'm a bit of a start, like a tech startup girl at heart, woman at heart. I right out of college, I worked for a startup called Wildfire. It was acquired by Google in 2012. That's how I got to Google. I was in on the ads team for a long time. I'll never forget first moment walking into Google offices and meeting some folks on the YouTube team and just being like, oh, that's my home. I need to figure out a way to get onto the YouTube team. I know I will thrive there. I just want to work with creators. Like the fact that people are making income and making a lot of money, like making stuff about what they love to do, that just really struck home with me. So from that moment up until about 6 years later, I was basically just trying to pivot myself slowly but surely to the YouTube team. Area 120 ended up being that like ultimate sort of like lily pad or stepping stone to YouTube. So Area 120, not to be confused with Area 51, which people are like, aliens? I'm like, yeah, that's it. That's Google and aliens are working together. But
that's a good conspiracy theory.
It was like, I know they knew what they were doing, like coming up with that.
No comment.
Anyway, a like white van just pulls up like 5 minutes after our chat. I'm like, hello. Anyway, Area 120 was awesome. It was, yeah, an internal incubator. So the way that that worked is you would come up with an idea as a founder, you'd pitch it to a board, they would approve it, and then they'd actually give you funding, like millions of dollars to build out the concept. I myself didn't come up with an idea, but I found someone who did. And the person at Area 120 that I ended up working for, he wanted to make live streaming on YouTube much easier. So initially it was actually all just an audio product, called Stations. And then we revised it into Rodeo to be a live, like a co-streaming tool. Because going live on YouTube is actually quite hard. It's still pretty complex. Like you need an encoder. You know, if you want to bring someone else into your stream, you have to go through quite a few steps.
I feel like a lot of people stream on Twitch, but then have a lot of like, you know, their, the edited versions of the recordings then have a very large second life on YouTube. It's this classic relationship.
Yes. Yes. And, it's really the sort of like live on YouTube has a lot of kind of history and a lot of area for improvement. So we built this app. It was a standalone app. I was the only non-engineer on the team, but I was helping bring creators to test it, try it out. It was a standalone app that allowed people to go live on YouTube and then bring people very easily into the stream. Man, we got some heavy hitters to use it because it was really a great use case for musicians. So they would have a song dropping, like Justin Bieber and Shawn Mendes had a collab that was dropping. So he, you know, it's hilarious. Like he's downloading Rodeo and like bringing someone else into the stream from a different place. And this was during COVID when people couldn't physically get together. So it kind of blew up during that chapter too. Anyway, it was such a success that YouTube Eng, and this is the ideal situation. You want to build something in Area 120 that it has so much value to another part of Google or YouTube in this case that they acquire you. So they acquired us out of YouTube. And at that point, I was actually given the option to figure out another path from it. They're like, you can work anywhere. Like here are the different teams and options. Here are the open positions. But I was like, wait, this is... I could work for you. I have YouTube experience now. Cause the reason I couldn't get a job on YouTube during my ad days is I didn't have any kind of YouTube experience or I didn't have any like talent experience. So Area 120 was the thing that allowed me to do that. And then, again, I'll never forget. It was kind of, coincidental, this woman who I was friends with, who ran the top creator team, the public figures team at YouTube, someone had just left her team. And there was a headcount open and I was like, can I please apply for this role? So I ended up getting it. And so I was there for my final 3-4 years on the YouTube team, nice. Making my dreams come true.
You've been doing this now for a year, right?
A little bit over. So I started my LLC, yeah, March of last year. But I left YouTube like January. So It's been almost a year and a half, which is pretty wild.
Mm-hmm. Was it like, you know, basically no other path you were going to do. You really liked working with creators. You'd got there, you'd gotten to where you wanted to go. You're like, I'm going to find a way to leverage now this skill set and these relationships you'd built, into doing this independently?
Yeah, so really the biggest kind of aha moment for me was seeing how much more support creators really needed. Mm. I, in this partner management role, it was awesome because we interfaced with a lot of creators, but because there was just such a big portfolio, I found myself not having enough time to really like take care of people, nor was it really my position at YouTube. You know, there's, YouTube was providing creators with a free service, which is incredible. You have this partner manager, but I felt that there was just so much more that we could do from a content strategy standpoint, or that I wanted to do, that I couldn't. Plus the role was kind of always evolving. It was a lot of deal work. It was a lot of project-based work, and that would then take me away from the stuff that I really wanted to do, which is just grow channels, take care of talent. And so, just had a bit of an aha moment. It also, I think, was just time. I was really ready to go back to my like startup roots.
I mean, after being within even at, you know, Area 120, even, you know, you're at Google for like, for a decade, that's a long time.
It's a long ass time.
Okay. Wait, one thing though, you said is when you left and you felt like there was so much opportunity for, you know, creators needed to be served in these various ways. This is something that I have been thinking a lot about recently, is that, well, you know, when people talk about the creator economy, they talk about creators, and that's what your average person thinks of, right? They think about creators. But as the creator economy has grown, I think it was the Interactive Advertising Bureau report released earlier this year in 2020, there was 200,000 full-time equivalent creators. Now there is 1.5 million. You know, the amount of really good, sophisticated creators producing high-quality content, making a living, has increased, but so has the amount of more middle-of-the-road people who, like, by dint of not being an expert in audience development or monetization or, like, specific production processes, like, that's also risen. And so I think there is a very large, perhaps increasing opportunity for people doing the kind of work you're doing, creator service providers, whether it's audience development, whether it's content strategy, whether it's, you know, like, bringing people together in like co-ops as business structures, whatever. I think that is a huge opportunity. And I'm curious to hear your thoughts on it.
Yes. I mean, well, I'll selfishly say, if anyone wants to come help me, I'm looking for more channel strategists. Like I need more help, but the demand has been incredible. Like that was, you know, in sort of witnessing the volume of huge talent and also just like talent that was growing so quickly. That's also where my brain had that reaction of like, wow, the market for this is already huge and it's not going to stop growing. And I felt like there were only kind of a handful of YouTube strategists at the time. My also perspective is like the more strategists there are, the more value that our like strategy community can create. And also the more like validating the role has become. So I've actually talked to a couple of people, one person specifically, into breaking off and doing what I'm doing, but for kind of like a different segment of creators. And then there's a couple of other strategists that I partner with and we work on clients together. So there's more than enough opportunity. It will continue to grow. I think also YouTube is, I mean, it's interesting. I do feel like there is another kind of wave of interest around YouTube. It's like Shorts was a big magnet, sort of like now YouTube as a podcast platform is a really big kind of point of focus. I can tell also YouTube marketing, you know, since the time I left, has really been focused on like breaking down the norms of Hollywood, or really like positioning YouTube as this tool or this place, this platform that should be included in the Hollywood conversation. Like, you know, Amelia de Moldenberg, her content series should be considered for awards, things like
she
that.
She just won the Webby Award too for, it was like a special, it was the special achievement for something like that. And Sean Evans, you know, presented her. Yes. It was this whole thing, but stressing that like, you know, over the past 11 years, she's really risen to this like this full-on entrepreneur. Another thing actually on this same tip, while eating lunch today, I was listening to this week's episode of The Rebooting Show from Brian Morrissey, and he was interviewing Nicholas Carlson, who used to be at Business Insider and made them this kind of video juggernaut, and now he has recently started his own business, Dynamo, and they were talking about how there's no text, there's no articles. It's fully on YouTube. So I think kind of what you're talking about too, not just the Hollywood of it, but like B2B media, all sorts of media are like accepting that like YouTube is this stable platform really that's not going anywhere and like has a powerful distribution mechanism. This podcast is on YouTube and it became video first because I was advised that that's the easiest way to grow a podcast if you're not part of an existing network. And we have seen growth here for sure. I wanted to ask though about your business and the growth of it. So you're in some change that you've been doing this. I understand it's just you, but you're working in collaboration with other people. You're mentioning, let's say by the end of, a year from now. And then also let's say 4 years from now. So when it's been about 2 years and about five, what are some of your realistic versions of like, well, this is what it'll look like. I'll have this many people. I'll have like people doing X role, Y role, Z role. So in 2 years and then in 5 years, dreaming a little bigger.
Yes. Love it. So number one goal, I would say the sort of primary business goal for us is to increase retainer clients for a couple of reasons. At highest value for the creator, highest value for my business. It's the work I love doing the most. So what is required to support a retainer client is myself. I actually have a data analyst and a writer. I would consider that like a pod. And what my goal is over the next couple of years is to create more pods. So to hopefully find someone that I can train on everything I know and kind of copy paste myself into someone who also has the same interests and wants to do the same work. My goal is to create another pod in the next like 6 to 9 months. So I can double the size of the business. You know, each pod I think can work, you can kind of amount to like a certain amount of clients. We're still trying to figure out exactly what that threshold is. And then eventually I'd love to see it kind of verticalized. So, you know, we have a health pod, myself is more like lifestyle and entertainment, for example, kids, beauty. Like I would love to see it grow into something of that size. Maybe that's more like 3-4 years down the road.
The writer and data analyst quick, are they full time?
Yeah.
Awesome.
No, part-time.
Part-time.
Sorry.
Well, also awesome.
But, I would say the data analyst, he's technically part-time. I think he's working on about 75% of the clients that I've got. And then he has his own business. So I would consider that part-time. I wouldn't be surprised if it moved more toward like a full-time kind of position. That would be the goal. I want to have, you know, full-time folks soon.
One question that I would be remiss if I didn't ask, because I always ask it. How do you define the term creator in the content sense?
Okay, so I will be honest. I actually had a tough time answering because I was thinking about this last couple of days. I'm going to come at it probably more from, have you read The Artist's Way?
I have a copy of it. I haven't read it. I'll be honest.
I feel like it's a book that I've read it a couple of times. It was really helpful when I was kind of birthing this business into being, help keep me focused. I would say a creator is an artist, and an artist really can be anyone. I mean, you can be kind of creative or artful in so many different mechanisms. I think in sort of the world that we work in, I think if you're able to put yourself out on the line, meaning like uploading content equals being vulnerable, if you're able to do that and commit to that, I would consider that a creator. So that's again, kind of like that focus and around the word upload. I think that there's just a lot of meaning behind that action. And whenever you commit to composing something and then putting it out there, I think that's taking a risk on yourself. I think that's, I would define that as a creator.
That's a good answer. I'm always going back and forth, but that kind of aligns with my broad version, which is, anybody who's contributing to the corpus of the internet.
I like that. And I also, because I do think everyone kind of, it's built on technical backbone, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, the internet or YouTube, for example. But I do think that there's so much magic with YouTube because I feel it too. I see it and kind of how like YouTube mirrors creators' confidence. Mm-hmm. I have seen, and I can't explain that. And I think it's also, you know, that when I worked at YouTube, everyone would say it's not the algorithm, it's the audience. It's like basically a whatever's sort of performing well on YouTube is a reflection of like what humans are like generally interested in, you know? It's like how we're all kind of moving together and creating and reacting together.
Well, you were saying earlier, how you were kind of alluding to implying that, like, you know, you don't like to take stock in these kind of abstracted, magical thinking ways people talk about the algorithm. But what you're saying here is like it's important to understand the algorithm as like a one of the major inputs is like it's just learning what people respond to and then like codifying that and accelerating that.
Yes. Yes. Like I would kind of say, you know, there's a lot of, I think my pet peeve is when people post videos of like the YouTube algorithm has changed again. It's changed again.
It's great clickbait.
It is. It is totally. Yeah. It, you know, it still catches my attention. I think that, you know, the algorithm will never endure like abrupt changes. Like technically, like from a machine learning standpoint, that's just not how it works. However, YouTube will change its priorities. So if the priority is now to drive shorts adoption, you're going to see a shit ton of shorts inventory open up, and you're going to see a huge initiative to bring big TikTokers onto the platform. And so that will then it changed the way that users behave with YouTube and therefore change the way that content is served up. Same with podcasts, same with all these different formats. But I think that like at the end of the day, and this is what's really hard with YouTube. It's so easy to get stuck in the dance of data and just only talk about CTR, only talk about, average percentage viewed, but what often gets lost is connecting to what humans want. So if you can have someone like me or someone on your team that is reminding you of those two pieces, like it's kind of tough to go wrong because you're really considering both the quantitative and the qualitative, the human and the technical.
I think this is almost a good place to end it. So I think I want to ask you any advice you would give to creators, maybe specific strategic or tactical advice that's very implementable, you know, close the tab on this podcast and go do it. Good advice besides hiring the Upload Club.
Love that. I often find myself answering this question with just start.
Okay. I'm sorry to interrupt you. I think that's my favorite piece of advice that I've put in the newsletter so many times. It's like,
oh, good.
Literally just do it.
Just get started.
Just do it. Literally nothing. There's nothing that matters more. It's like, you know, how do you get in shape for whatever, you know, you walk out your door and you start running, right? It's the best piece of advice. Really the only part that matters, because you can listen to all the tactical strategic advice, whatever that you like.
Yes.
Exactly. But if you don't actually do it, it doesn't matter. But I am going to press you for one more specific tactical piece.
So two things. I'm going to first also, I have an ideation worksheet that lives in my newsletter. I can send it to you.
We should link that in the newsletter.
Link it. but that is a great place to start. It takes you through everything we discussed today and even in more detail. It does have a few Artist Way tools in there.
It's a bestseller for a reason.
It's so great. The morning pages stuff, which is just free writing, I think is kind of at the foundation of just getting started. So if you wanted to make the get started recommendation actionable, start with kind of morning pages or just free writing. Because I do think that just like taking action brings clarity. So that ideation worksheet is great. I think from a packaging standpoint, today, my homework for the listener is to have them go onto YouTube and look at watch some of their favorite YouTube videos and really study the packaging of those videos. So taking a look at the thumbnail, taking a look at the title and trying to understand what is it about this thumbnail that inspired you to click. Mm-hmm. So for example, I have been watching a lot of Star Wars lightsaber scenes lately. Not kidding. I'm a huge Star Wars fan. Hayden and Ewan McGregor have an incredible fight sequence in Return of the Sith. And what YouTube now knows is that I'm interested in their friendship. And so they now YouTube is serving me up like, oh, Hayden and Ewan are best friends, blah, blah, blah. And so that's interesting to me. I'm like, oh, that's so sweet. So for me, the thing that's resonating is this like kind of emotional friendship angle. So that's sort of the thing that's going to continue to resonate with me. But what is the thing for the viewer? What is the sort of motive or the incentive? Once you really understand the psychology of the click, that's when packaging gets a lot easier.
I fully agree. I think this is across all media, whether it's like you're on Instagram and you want to make reels that get a lot of views, you have a newsletter, you want to get a higher open rate, whatever. It's like whenever, like if there's one that you really like if you're scrolling reels and you find yourself watching this one, like, go back, scroll down, scroll back up, look at how it starts. Like,
yes.
Look at every detail. What's the first second? What's the lighting? What kind of camera are they using? Like, is there text in the pit? Where is it played? Like, it's just about like, you know, there are always so many details that you don't think about, and it's about codifying them all and breaking them down.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. I love that.
Wonder right there.
Do it. Just do it.
And just go to theuploadclub.com. Is there anything else you want to plug?
No, just thank you for listening. I just am thrilled to be here. Thank you for your time, both you
really
and the viewer.
Yes. listener, I will see you next week. This was a great episode.